You know, when a tire blows out on the highway, it is a really dramatic event. Like there is a loud bang, the steering wheel violently jerks, and you are immediately skidding over to the shoulder.
Right, it's undeniable.
Exactly. It demands your attention right that second. But then there is the slow leak, the invisible tiny puncture. You drive on it for weeks, totally oblivious to the loss of pressure, adjusting your steering just a tiny bit to compensate without even
Now
realizing
you
it.
think everything is fine.
Yeah, until one morning you walk out to the driveway and the car is just resting flat on the rim. And you know, that slow, undetectable leak, that is exactly how most of us lose our sense of identity. Welcome to a brand new deep dive. We are so glad you're here with us today.
Absolutely.
Today, we are diving into a really insightful new ebook published this month, August 2026, by Dirk Werner. It's called How Not to Give Up on Yourself. And the core premise here completely flips our cultural understanding of burnout and self-alienation.
It really does. Because we tend to think of losing yourself as this cinematic, explosive breakdown, right?
Right, the blowout.
Exactly. But Werner argues it is almost always a quiet, gradual fade. It only becomes apparent when you suddenly look around and realize you no longer recognize the person making your daily decisions.
So our mission today is to unpack the psychology behind this self-alienation. We want to explore how our cultural environments quietly push us away from our true selves, and most importantly, map out Werner's highly practical strategies to reclaim your inner compass.
Because there are some genuinely great tools in this book.
Oh, totally. Okay, let's unpack this. I want to start with what it actually means to, you know, lose yourself on a biological and psychological level. Werner points out that psychological stability rests on a very specific foundation, which is the alignment between what you feel and what you do.
What's fascinating here is how that misalignment actually manifests in the body. Like when you are constantly acting against your inner convictions just to meet external expectations.
Whether that is at work or in a relationship or whatever.
Right, it doesn't just stay in your head. It translates into chronic restlessness, irritability, and this pervasive sense of depersonalization. Werner describes this as feeling like a guest in your own life.
A guest in your own life, that is such a heavy way to put it.
It really is.
Yeah.
You are going through the motions, but the person executing those actions feels completely disconnected from your core values. And this often happens in high-stress environments where the sheer volume of demands just forces you into a purely reactive state.
We see this vividly in the book through the story of Miriam. She is a 48-year-old director of a city hospital emergency room, and she finishes this brutal shift where two resuscitation attempts failed.
Just an unimaginably hard night.
Yeah. And she walks out to her car at 4 in the morning, sits in the driver's seat, and physically cannot turn the key in the ignition. She is just completely flat.
Right.
Now, the conventional narrative dictates that this is the moment Miriam quits, right? She is experiencing moral injury. She has immense responsibility for human life, but lacks the systemic control to save everyone. But she doesn't walk away.
No, she does something really unexpected.
Yeah, she gets a ring-bound notebook, and at the end of every single shift, before she turns that car key, she writes down one sentence. Just one. She writes, "What was beyond her control today?"
And the psychology behind that single sentence is brilliant because of the mechanism at play. Writing it down externalizes the cognitive load. When you are traumatized or overwhelmed, the brain tends to catastrophize.
Right, everything becomes one big disaster.
Exactly. It blends all failures together into one massive narrative of personal inadequacy. But by forcing herself to physically write down the boundary between her specific actions and the random, uncontrollable nature of mortality, Miriam is engaging her prefrontal cortex.
She is actively interrupting the emotional flooding from her amygdala.
Spot on. And after 6 months and about 100 of these sentences, you know, she hasn't fixed the healthcare system. But she has drawn a hard psychological line between her actual responsibilities and the burdens of the universe that she just cannot carry.
That distinction between what you can control and what you can't feels like the core of resilience. But that makes me question our working definition of authenticity here.
How so?
Well, does staying true to yourself mean refusing to change? Like, if you are constantly drawing lines to protect your identity, do you just become this rigid statue standing against the wind, completely inflexible? Because the world demands adaptation.
That is a great point.
Yeah.
But authenticity is definitely not about cementing a rigid image of yourself and refusing to adapt. That is actually a defense mechanism, not authenticity.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Staying true to yourselves means keeping your own voice in the decisions you make as things change around you. Modern pressures, like the constant curation of digital media or rapid economic shifts, they often force conformity.
Right, they demand that we mask our true reactions just to survive socially or professionally.
Exactly. But when you continually sacrifice your personal needs and values to adapt to an environment, you undergo a slow decay of intrinsic motivation. You literally lose the joy in things that used to come naturally because your brain learns that your internal desires don't matter.
Which brings us to how we process the stress that causes that decay in the first place. When we suppress our internal reality, we are essentially ignoring vital sensory input. I think about emotions kind of like our body's physical pain receptors, but for our psychological environment.
Oh, that's a really good way to frame it.
Right. Like, if you touch a hot stove, the intense pain isn't your enemy. It is urgent, critical data telling you to move your hand. But if you panic, flail wildly, and knock over a pot of boiling water, you've made the situation worse.
Right, you reacted instead of responding.
Yeah. The goal isn't to deaden the nerve so you don't feel the burn, nor is it to let the pain completely dictate a chaotic reaction. It is about reading the data and removing your hand deliberately.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, attempting to deaden those nerves is exactly where society is currently failing. We are looking at a global environment that keeps people in a state of persistent tension.
The statistics in the book are wild.
Staggering. In 2019, according to the WHO, about 970 million people had a mental disorder. And by 2021, it was 1.1 billion.
Wow. That's nearly one in seven people worldwide.
Yeah. This is not a scattered collection of private failures. It is a structural societal challenge. So the question becomes how we regulate our internal systems within a pressurized environment.
And Verner heavily emphasizes emotional intelligence, or EQ, here, right?
He does, but not as an innate personality trait. He frames it as a structured, learnable competence. It involves perceiving your inner states, controlling impulses, understanding others, and handling social relationships.
And the neuroscience behind learning that competence is phenomenal. Like, we look at Britta Holzl's studies from 2010 and 2011 on mindfulness-based stress reduction. We are not talking about just sitting quietly and feeling relaxed. We are talking about literal structural neuroplasticity.
It physically changes the brain.
Yes. Her studies showed that just 8 weeks of mindfulness programs can structurally change the brain, specifically areas related to stress processing, like the amygdala.
Which is the brain's fear center.
Right. When you practice observing a stressful trigger without immediately reacting to it, you are actively weakening the synaptic links between the stimulus and your automatic fight or flight response. You're structurally rebuilding your brain's alarm system to be more accurate and less volatile.
It proves that feelings have a physical reality. They're not abstract clouds. And this is why Verner explicitly warns that avoiding negative emotions is a dangerous trap.
Because you're avoiding real data.
Exactly. In behavioral economics, loss aversion demonstrates that people will make highly irrational, risky decisions just to avoid the physiological discomfort of losing something. Our unexamined fears subconsciously drive our actions.
So if you treat negative emotions as something to be suppressed, you are just flying blind.
Yes. You cut off your access to the very data you need to navigate complex environments, and you will inevitably make decisions that betray your true self just to alleviate temporary anxiety.
That sets up a fascinating critique of modern culture, because we are constantly bombarded by this mandate from self-help gurus and corporate culture to just think positive.
No, toxic positivity. Yeah. Verner absolutely skewers this idea.
He really does. And the mechanism behind why forced optimism is so damaging comes down to cognitive dissonance. Like when there are mass layoffs at a company, for example, and management insists that we are all a family and this is an exciting new chapter.
Yeah. The worst.
Right. They are forcing employees to hold two contradictory realities in their heads. The employee is genuinely overwhelmed and fearful, but the culture demands a happy face. The mental bandwidth required to suppress your internal reality and project a fake one consumes an enormous amount of metabolic energy.
It rapidly leads to emotional and physical exhaustion. And that exhaustion erodes your authentic self faster than pessimism ever could.
Is it possible that forcing yourself to be optimistic actually erodes your authentic self even faster than just being pessimistic?
Oh, without a doubt. Using positive thinking as an escape hatch creates a superficial conformity. You stop reflecting honestly, you stop learning from failures, and you start relying on automated, hollow affirmations.
So what is the alternative? Just dwelling on the negative?
No, the alternative is realistic optimism. Martin Seligman actually did a study with 411 participants where they just wrote down three positive things daily.
Just three things?
Yeah, and it lowered depressive symptoms for up to 6 months. It's not about ignoring reality, but noticing the positive alongside the hard stuff. It is an audit of reality.
And part of that reality is that we are biologically wired to need other people to regulate our nervous systems. Julian Holt-Lunstead did a massive meta-analysis, like 148 studies, almost 309,000 participants.
That is a huge sample size.
Huge. And she found that strong social connections increase survival probability by about 50%. Human beings use co-regulation. A single reliable confidant literally down-regulates your stress response.
True resilience requires psychological safety, not mandatory cheerfulness. We see this in organizational psychology, too. Amy Edmondson's 1999 study on 51 work teams proved this perfectly.
What did she find?
Teams where open disagreement is permitted, where individuals can say this project is failing, without facing shame or retaliation, they consistently perform better. They learn from mistakes because they are dealing with reality, not a curated fantasy.
This raises an important question, though. Here's where it gets really interesting. If we rely on our social and cultural environments to validate our reality, what happens when those environments are incredibly complex or even contradictory?
That is the reality for so many people today.
Right. We live in an era defined by globalization. Millions of people live in massive multicultural urban centers where they are constantly navigating multiple, sometimes conflicting sets of cultural expectations.
Yeah, you look at the demographic data in the book. Oh. In Berlin, in 2025, 41.7% of residents had a migration background. Toronto in 2021 had 46.6% born abroad, and Sydney is 38.6%.
Over half of Australia is first or second generation immigrants. So how does someone weave multiple cultural identities together without feeling like they're just code switching or people pleasing to fit in?
This raises an important question about how we view identity, because people assume having multiple cultural ties means you're fractured. But Nguyen and Bene Martinez did a 2013 meta-analysis with about 23,000 participants.
And what did they see?
They found that people with bicultural anchoring actually show better psychological and social adaptation.
Wow, so they actually adapt better.
Yes, because of cognitive flexibility. They aren't being chameleons masking their true selves. They practice navigating different norms and communication styles daily, which builds an incredible tolerance for ambiguity.
So having multiple cultural ties isn't a weakness, it's a source of cognitive flexibility.
Exactly. It doesn't mean rejecting your roots, but renegotiating them into a vibrant, ever-changing whole. It's about curiosity, not conformity.
And that curiosity actively reshapes the wider society. Pettigrew and Tropp did a meta-analysis of 515 studies with over 250,000 people. It showed that contact between groups dramatically reduces prejudice and increases perspective taking.
It breaks down monolithic thinking.
It proves that our identities aren't threatened by encountering diversity, they are enriched by it.
Absolutely. So, if we transition from the theoretical to the practical, how do we actually build this cognitive flexibility and protect our authentic selves from the slow leak?
Right, because we need actionable tools. So what does this all mean?
Well, Werner provides some very tactical, pragmatic tools. We can look at Tarek, a 34-year-old consultant. He realized he was advocating things he didn't believe in at work. He was experiencing that deep misalignment.
But he didn't, like, flip a table and dramatically quit his job the next day, right?
No, he didn't make a dramatic exit. Instead, he negotiated a 4-day work week. He took Tuesdays and volunteered as a debt counselor. Tuesday became his benchmark for authenticity.
A space where his actions aligned with his values.
Exactly. And it took him 80 Tuesdays to completely switch careers. Over those 80 Tuesdays, he built a new neural pathway of reward based on his internal values, which eventually outcompeted the external reward of his consulting paycheck.
It is so incredibly grounded. And we see a similar structural approach with Hannah, who is 61. She suffered the dual tragedy of losing her husband and her library job within 14 months.
It's devastating.
Yeah. But her survival strategy wasn't to search for profound meaning or to cure her grief. Instead, she established 3 non-negotiable weekly commitments. She swam on Mondays, called her sister on Wednesdays, and bought groceries for a neighbor on Fridays.
Those small actions didn't fix the grief, but they built a framework where grief wouldn't overwhelm her completely. It gave her small, manageable points of agency. She was building autonomous motivation.
Doing things because they aligned with her core self.
Right. And to help build that kind of framework, Werner offers a couple of specific exercises from Chapter 9. One is called the Yes-No List.
Oh, I love this one.
It's so good. You take time at the end of the week, review your commitments, and meticulously mark whether you made each one out of genuine conviction or purely for conflict avoidance.
It is like doing an audit on your bank statement, but instead of tracking where your money is going, you are tracking where your identity is being spent.
That is a perfect way to put it. You can physically see the places where you are bankrupting your own values just to keep the peace.
And what was the other exercise? The one with three people?
Yeah, the one question for three people. You select three individuals from entirely different contexts of your life, like work, family, and friends, and you ask them all the exact same question. In what moments do I seem most like myself to you?
Which is deeply vulnerable.
Very. And the rule is, you just listen. You don't argue, you don't justify, you just collect the data. True resilience, like we see with Tarek and Hannah, doesn't rely on grand moments, but on small, often unobserved daily decisions.
So, to wrap this all up for you listening right now, staying true to yourself isn't about fighting the world loudly. It is not about adopting a rigid persona. It is about checking your inner dashboard, using your emotions as data, honoring your complex identity, and making small, honest choices week by week.
And I want to leave you with one final concept from Verner's book, from chapter 10.3, to just mull over. We often think of role models as famous heroes, but Verner argues that the most powerful role models in our lives are often entirely unobserved.
Like the story of the apprentice.
Exactly. He shares this anecdote of a young apprentice on a construction site. This young man's entire decision-making compass was permanently shaped by watching an older colleague secretly fix a structural error on a roof truss.
An error that would have been covered up by drywall, right? No one else would have ever noticed it.
No one. The older colleague didn't do it for praise. He didn't even know the apprentice was watching. He just fixed it because his internal alignment demanded it. That quiet, unobserved choice became the apprentice's lifelong standard for integrity. So the thought we want to leave you with today is this. Who is secretly watching you? And what quiet, unobserved choice of yours might become their lifelong inner compass?
That is such a powerful question to end on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.